China's leader, Xi Jinping, recently did something he almost never does: give someone a hug. Xi is many things. He's stern, he's stately, and thanks to his elaborate cult of personality, he's everywhere. But one thing he's not is emotionally expressive. You would never catch him donning a Stetson, grinning and waving to a crowd, as Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping did on his 1979 trip to Texas. Nor would he lose his cool, calling a reporter simple and naive, as Jiang Zemin did 20 years later.
Too simple. Huh? Sometimes naive.
In other words, Xi's May 2024 hug was as significant as it was awkward, particularly because of its recipient, Vladimir Putin. The last time a Russian and Chinese leader embraced so effusively, the two countries were in a full-blown alliance. When Mao Zedong traveled to Moscow in 1950 to sign that treaty, it was one of just two times he ever left Chinese soil. But their alliance would not last. Within a few short years, the two countries grew increasingly hostile in what's now known as the Sino-Soviet split. At the heart of this division were ideological differences, personal animosity between Mao and Khrushchev, and a glaring power imbalance between the USSR, a nuclear superpower, and China, a young, still developing nation. In 1969, they nearly went to war. And this split, 60 years ago, was the first domino to fall in a chain reaction that would eventually produce the China and the world we know today. If China wasn't left weak, isolated, and fearful of Russia, it may never have been receptive to America's advances. Without Richard Nixon's 1972 trip to Beijing, there would be no 1979 normalization of relations. Without normalization, there would be no reform and opening. Without it, China would never have become the world factory. And finally, without the meteoric economic rise enabled by the reform era, there would be no Chinese middle class for Hollywood to appease, or Foxconn to manufacture the iPhone. The beginning of this post-Cold War era came in 1991. After the Soviet collapse, America's global supremacy was complete, ushering in an unprecedented era of relative peace and prosperity. The United States was not without enemies. Sure, there were a few stragglers, your Cubas and your North Koreas, but each was too economically trivial and too geopolitically isolated to matter. The US and its allies could more or less ignore these left-behind relics of the Cold War. Perhaps it seemed at the time, indefinitely. But in hindsight, it's now clear that history had not, in fact, ended. The first sign of trouble came in 2008, the year Washington unleashed the worst financial crisis on the world since the Great Depression, sowing doubt in its leadership. Meanwhile, China not only emerged unscathed, but it did so by building shiny new trains, airports, roads, bridges, and skyscrapers. That same year, Beijing hosted its first ever Olympic Games, fueling intense patriotism. The contrast had never been so extreme. China's global reputation reached an all-time high, while America's fell precipitously. Then, in 2014, Russia invaded Crimea. Within weeks, Moscow was expelled from the G8, roundly condemned, and sanctioned by the US and its allies. Estranged once again from the US-led global order, Putin began shopping for new partners. Someone, ideally, with an insatiable appetite for oil and a willingness to overlook certain uncomfortable topics. China checked all the boxes and then some. It consumes 5 times as much oil as Canada, yet produces even less. It shares with Russia a 2,600-mile border, the 6th longest in the world, longer than the one between the US and Mexico. Not to mention, Putin and Xi are both 71-year-old men who've cracked down on dissidents, fanned the flames of nationalism, aggressively pursued territorial expansion, and shamelessly dismantled their own term limits. It was a match made in heaven, and they weren't afraid to share it with the world. Since assuming power in 2012, she has met with Putin over 40 times, more than twice as many as any other country's leaders put together. The latter has traveled to China 20 times, and the former to Russia 9. Most recently, just 3 days after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Putin. Putin delivered Xi ice cream on his birthday. Xi awarded Putin a gold friendship medal. Putin invited Xi to his private Kremlin apartment. And the two have referred to each other as best, close, intimate, and dear friends. In other words, the China-Russia friendship has been quietly thawing over the past 50 years. But it was taken to a whole new level on February 4th, 2022. That day, all eyes were on Beijing for the opening day of the Winter Olympics, the sequel to its all-important 2008 Summer Olympics debut. And what did it do with this spotlight but use it as an opportunity to strengthen its relationship with Russia, announcing a, quote, no-limits friendship? The Olympics ended 16 days later. 4 days after that, Russian tanks crossed into Ukrainian territory, initiating what would turn out to be a brutal and protracted war. Since then, China has maintained what some call pro-Russian neutrality. Neutrality because it did not, for example, vote against the UN resolution condemning the invasion, but neither did it vote for the resolution. Like 34 other countries, it abstained. And pro-Russian because it has, however, extended Russia a critical lifeline at its most desperate hour, namely by buying Russian oil. Before the invasion, Europe imported nearly 2.5 million barrels of Russian oil a day. Today, less than 500,000. Meanwhile, Chinese imports have increased by roughly a third. Not only that, but China is receiving the friends and family of a war criminal discount. It benefits from the tragedy by way of bargain bin oil prices. Though it's not just oil. Over half of all Russian imports now come from China, up from just 25% a few years ago. Much of this is dual-use technology like semiconductors, meaning they can be used for both military and civilian purposes, giving China a veneer of plausible deniability. It's unclear whether Xi Jinping knew about the war in advance. One plausible theory is that Putin informed Xi of a vague military operation, which Xi asked him to delay until after the Olympics were over, and that Xi was as surprised by the scale and length of the war as the rest of the world. But regardless of what he knew, it's telling that in the 2 years since, China has chosen to maintain such close relations while Russia wages a violent attack on another nation. Now, this isn't the first time Moscow has invaded Ukraine, nor is it the first time Beijing has backed an aggressive nuclear-armed regime. But it is the first time since the Cold War that America's adversaries aren't isolated. And this presents a whole new set of challenges. In terms of overall capacity, neither the Russian nor Chinese military is any match for America's. Together, however, the two are even stronger, according to a 2017 RAND estimate. Safe and secure within their neighborhood, each is more free to venture further afield. Squint today and you can see many parallels to the Cold War. Something resembling rival blocs, a proxy war in Ukraine, non-aligned third nations like India, and a nuclear arms race. Still, for all these similarities, there also remain some major differences. Despite talk of an unbreakable, no-limits friendship, it certainly looks like there are, in fact, limits. China and Russia are not, for instance, formal allies. Neither has committed to come to the other's defense. Unlike North Korea, China has not contributed unambiguous military equipment like artillery shells or missiles to the war in Ukraine. Instead, it tries to present itself as a partner to Russia and a neutral, responsible mediator to the rest of the world. In reality, of course, this is an impossible needle to thread. Much of the world now sees China as an enabler and an opportunist. But that hasn't stopped it from trying. She has warned Putin not to use nuclear weapons, and many Chinese companies like Huawei have backed away from the Russian market to comply with sanctions. The difference between North Korea's direct and enthusiastic support of the war and China's softer, more veiled, indirect support is that one has nothing to lose, and the other, everything. Despite their frequent visits, hugs, and birthday parties, the truth is that Xi has a radically different position in and view of the world than Putin or Kim Jong-un. Moscow is firmly outside the US-led order. Having already been sanctioned, condemned, labeled a pariah, and expelled from various multilateral organizations, things can only get better. This affords the Kremlin a certain degree of freedom. With nothing at stake, it's free to sow chaos without paying a price. China, on the other hand, simply can't afford such recklessness. Sure, it has moved in the direction of self-sufficiency, slowly cutting itself off from the world. But it remains, and will remain for the foreseeable future, deeply embedded in the global order. The American and Soviet economies were virtually disconnected, trading almost nothing, while China is today the former's largest source of imports. Decoupling is the word of the day, yet Chinese exports are at a near all-time high. In 2022, Beijing was the number one trading partner for 140 countries. Political engagement, cultural exchange, and trade may not have remade China into the liberal utopia Nixon or Clinton imagined, but they have given it real incentives to play along, if only superficially. In summary, China seeks to change the global order yet maintain its stability. Russia seeks to destroy it. What unites the two is not a positive vision for the future, but a negative reaction to US dominance. They're anti-America, but not really pro-anything. The US and many of its allies, like the UK, by contrast, share a common language, cultural affinity, and the same fundamental values. During the Cold War, the world was split into two ideological blocs, each trying to win a war of ideas. Today, neither side is nearly as interested in promoting its cause so much as winning, period. Disenchanted and disillusioned by endless wars, the American public has taken an unmistakably inward turn. Voters across the spectrum are increasingly reluctant to send troops abroad, and when they do, the costs are closely scrutinized. Once a bipartisan rallying cry, the virtue of spreading American values across the globe is now up for debate. China, likewise, has its own flavor of insularity. Sure, just as America has freedom and democracy, officially, China promotes sovereignty and multipolarity. Sovereignty meaning that each country is free from foreign influence, sanctions or regime change, or external criticism about what happens within its borders. And multipolarity, meaning that no single country is more powerful than the rest. Now, at first glance, this would seem like a highly compelling vision. Say you're a country like Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia or Senegal in West Africa. You might feel left behind and overlooked by the post-Cold War US-led order. You might welcome a less rigid, more development-oriented model. Less rules and red tape, and more building roads and feeding mouths. And as a smaller country, you might be receptive to China's promise of absolute sovereignty and a greater balance between world powers. But whatever enthusiasm you may have will likely diminish after watching Beijing stand by Russia as it flagrantly violates Ukrainian sovereignty. In fact, many of the small countries most in need of protection are China's own neighbors, places like Taiwan, Bhutan, Hong Kong, and Vietnam. These values are only as credible as China upholds them, even when doing so is inconvenient. Otherwise, lofty principles like sovereignty become indistinguishable from a pro-China, anti-America agenda in disguise. Hardly an inspiring model for the rest of the world to follow. China's vision for the world is unlikely to spread as widely as the Soviet Union's. Never mind that this isn't really an ideology in the way communism was for the USSR. You might say sovereignty and multipolarity are exact opposites of ideology. Rather than a single coherent set of policies, each is a license for each country to do what it wants, whatever that may be. Both Stalin and Mao were committed to spreading their ideologies by supporting regime change, funding guerrillas, and producing international propaganda. Xi, on the other hand, makes no claim that China's model is universal. It's even in the name, socialism with Chinese characteristics. Instead, he promotes what some have labeled Han exceptionalism, the idea that the Chinese civilization, but especially Han Chinese, are unique, superior, and destined for greatness. This doesn't even leave room for all Chinese people, never mind all people around the globe, except perhaps as props. Now, none of this stops each country from using ideological language when useful. China leans into its sovereignty angle when trying to open up developing countries for investment, after which its relationship becomes highly transactional. Likewise, President Biden refers to a global fight between autocracy and democracy, a framing that enables both Democrats and Republicans to pass policies that often have very little to do with autocracy or democracy, like repairing highways or rebuilding factories. In other words, China and Russia have different goals and different means to achieve them. Neither tries very hard to create converts. And even what little preaching they do about sovereignty and multipolarity isn't all that effective. But that doesn't mean they can't work together. The enemy of your enemy, after all, is your friend. As long as relations with the US remain tense, each will have an incentive to overlook their differences, if only temporarily. Eventually, if history is any indication, they may drift apart. The 1960s Sino-Soviet split, recall, was driven in part by a glaring power imbalance. At that time, the Soviets were leaps and bounds ahead, supporting their smaller neighbor both militarily and economically. Today, the tables have turned, and China is now unmistakably the more powerful country. Its economy is almost 9 times larger, and 25% of all imports to Russia come from China, whereas just 5% of China's imports are from Russia. There are any number of potential cracks in their friendship. Russia is pushing to build a billion-dollar gas pipeline to China called the Power of Siberia 2, whereas China has resisted becoming too dependent on any single country for its energy. Russia considers the ex-Soviet Central Asian countries like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan to be its client states, but China is also eager to expand its influence in the region. Likewise, China and Russia compete for control of North Korea, which has long exploited this attention by playing each of its patrons off one another. Finally, Russia is more willing to engage in nuclear brinkmanship, which Beijing sees as dangerous and needlessly provocative. So, is this a Cold War? Do the similarities to, say, 1950 offset the differences? Without an agreed-upon definition or test, there's no definitive answer. But that's what makes this question so interesting. Because there's no definitive answer, there's an active, ongoing debate about whether we should use the Cold War label. On one side, proponents argue that America needs clarity. For the past few decades, they argue, Washington has had no single coherent China strategy. Sometimes we engage with China, keeping it close, connected, and invested in the global order. Other times we compete with China, to slow it down, or even, arguably, to contain it. And in trying to do these two things simultaneously, we fail at both. The first step, they say, is to admit what they would call the obvious, that the US and China are already locked in a competitive race. Only then can we win it. Critics, meanwhile, argue the Cold War label is at best counterproductive, and possibly even dangerous. First, they say, it elevates what should be a mere rivalry into an existential war between opposing civilizations. This can easily become a self-fulfilling prophecy, pushing China and Russia closer together, and further away from the US. It also serves as useful propaganda for the Chinese government to show that America will never accommodate its rise. Second, it can lay the foundation for a paranoid tribalism that opposes anything that remotely looks or sounds Chinese, even at the expense of destroying America's greatest strengths, our ability to draw and assimilate immigrants and indiscriminately borrow ideas from around the globe. The Cold War produced some of our greatest triumphs, the internet and the moon landing, for example. It also led to some of our most regrettable mistakes, proxy wars, McCarthyism, and nuclear proliferation. It remains to be seen whether this new era, whatever we call it, will bring out our best or worst. Let's hope it's the former. In which case, America is about to need a whole lot more scientists, engineers, and programmers. Unfortunately, schools tend to focus on specific skills, programming languages, and facts that quickly become outdated in this fast-moving era. The best way to prepare for this uncertain world is to invest in higher-level, universal, and transferable skills like problem-solving, consistent learning habits, and creative thinking. Which is why I love today's sponsor, Brilliant. Brilliant has courses on things like probability, logic, puzzles, statistics, and algorithms. It's designed around the principle that how you learn matters just as much as what you learn. You're more likely to really understand what you're learning when presented with the underlying concepts, like algorithms, rather than just memorizing code. You're more likely to keep returning day after day when you actually enjoy what you're learning. Imagine that. Brilliant's lessons are visually interesting, topically relevant, and highly interactive. A typical online course elsewhere might look like this, essentially a digital textbook and an unedited 2-hour lecture. Brilliant, on the other hand, guides you through the material step by step, with beautifully made and engaging interactive puzzles, interspersed with real projects and challenges that teach you how to analyze, think through, and solve a problem. Like how to use what you've learned to build a music recommendation algorithm for Spotify. To check out Brilliant completely free for 30 days, click the link on screen now or in the description below. That's brilliant.org/polymatter. Doing so will also get you 20% off an annual premium subscription. Go pick what interests you most and start learning today.